The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I have a little bit of a cold today, so I hope you'll forgive an occasional sniffle, but it's perfect because the topic for today is dukkha. I'd like to talk about understanding dukkha in particular. So this should be a bit of an exploration, and I hope that this will maybe change or deepen or somehow expand your view of what dukkha is and how to work with it in practice. It's a very important part of Buddhist practice. The most common translation that you'll hear of the word dukkha is suffering. But this is actually a pretty poor choice, as we'll see. And I may use it throughout this talk just because it's the most common, but keep in mind that there are other options. A somewhat better option, for example, is unsatisfactoriness. One teacher simply uses stress. And I've also even heard struggle as translations. But this is not a linguistic talk. I don't think we need to settle on a single word. I think it's more important to discover that this is actually a familiar experience in your own life and that you don't really need a word for it other than dukkha. So, first of all, dukkha is not at all a depressing thing to focus on. The Buddha taught suffering and the end of suffering. They're actually intimately linked. So one of the things that I actually appreciated about Buddhism when I first encountered it was the focus on dukkha. And the very first thing, the very first truth that the Buddha says is there is suffering. So this is very honest. You know, this is not at all a deceptive religion or spiritual practice. You're not going to come here and have someone say, if you just have the right positive attitude or Pollyanna kind of outlook on life, then all these things will go away. It's all fine. I mean, it is all fine, but you start with the fact that, yeah, actually, your life isn't that easy. It's honest. You're not going to be told otherwise. So I want to talk a little bit also during this talk about what suffering isn't, since a lot of people have some misconceptions in that area. So let's just jump in. The Buddha offers a clear definition of dukkha. It's said in many places in the sutta, and there's a classic rendering. It goes like this. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Association with the unloved is dukkha. Separation from the loved is dukkha. Not getting what one wants is dukkha. Do we know some of these things? So first he lists the blatant kind of suffering that we all know. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, including physical pain. So this is clear and immediate. I think we can all see this in our lives. And then he branches into the sort of deeper, more underlying problems with human existence, like separation from the loved. And that can mean just, you know, I'm not with the person that I want to be with right now. And it also means the death of the people that we love. This is going to happen during our lives. Union with the unloved. We don't always get to hang out with people that we like. That happens. We all know these. And they actually, being around this kind of everyday suffering is what drives our seeking of sensual pleasure and wanting to be something in the world, wanting to make something of ourselves or change our situation, or the converse of not wanting to be something, our desire to escape from certain things. This is our usual strategy, actually, is to try to minimize the unpleasant and maximize the pleasant. And why not, when there's dukkha every moment that we can feel? That's what we habitually learn to do. So Andy Olensky says, conventional strategies for human happiness entail various ways of maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. The problem is that pleasure is not ultimately sustainable and pain is not avoidable. The shortcoming of our usual approaches is that they treat the symptoms rather than addressing the underlying causes of the predicament, namely that unsatisfactoriness is part of the very fabric of existence. So the fact is that life is unsatisfactory when it's lived in the ordinary mode of seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. We feel a constant sense of lack, being unfulfilled, needing something, being insecure, being guarded, or just off. Actually, the root meaning of the words behind dukkha mean an axle that doesn't fit properly in the hole. And so you know how this feels in your life, right? You're driving along and the axle doesn't fit, so things are a little off. You're never quite there, you're late, and then you can't get it together, and there's just this feeling like it's not quite all there. That's dukkha. So even in high-option cultures like ours, when our lives are basically going well, which is true some of the time, we constantly create and act out this lack of fulfillment. Here's a quote from Ajahn Suchito about the running commentary you might have in your head. Are you sure you're doing the right thing in your life? Maybe you're missing out on a really great opportunity somewhere else. Then these multiple options become a strain. Can you develop shamanism, play classical guitar, study ecology and cybernetics, have a successful, fulfilling relationship with your partner, your parents and relatives, and your children, come to a mature understanding of the political arena, grow your own organic food, and hold down a suitable job with the right kinds of people for the right ends, all at the same time? If any of these go wrong, or if you miss out on a really fulfilling experience, then you feel disappointed or personally to blame. So cram it in and hold on tight. Yeah? So we sort of know this scenario at some time in our life, we might. So we're not even talking in this case about illness and tragedy, just the dukkha that we create for ourselves in everyday life. So we sense intuitively, actually, that it's impossible to get everything right. And I think we all sense that at some level. And in fact, even if we think we've done it for 10 minutes, then something changes and it isn't right anymore. So this is not an accident, and it's not some kind of personal failing to get your life together. This is the First Noble Truth. There is dukkha. It's built into ordinary human existence. So I hope this is getting your attention a little bit. The Buddha wasn't teaching something really obscure, some kind of bizarre philosophy that you have to study a lot. He taught the practicalities of your everyday life, and he taught a practical path whose depth is so profound that it can reach right into the nitty-gritty of your life and the fact that it feels unsatisfactory. So for a long time, we've believed that trying to fix and change things is the path to happiness, and a radical shift happens in our life when we begin to suspect that this isn't working and there might be an alternative. So here's the really interesting part, which is that the Buddha did find a way out of this struggle. And he did it by examining dukkha very carefully. He was a master of dukkha. And we can learn to understand dukkha too. So the teachings of the Buddha tell us the way. Basically, the unsatisfactoriness of life comes about because of our reactivity to experience. The problem is inside, not outside. And we can learn to let go of that reactivity. So that brings us to what dukkha is not. Dukkha is not actually unpleasant experience. And in particular, it's not pain. So if you get nothing else out of this talk, please remember that you can be in pain, physical pain or even mental pain of some kind, and not suffer. That's really important. I actually learned that myself from having years of chronic pain for a while. And it's also true in every meditation session when some kind of a difficult emotion arises and we're simply present with mindfulness. It can be there and we cannot be suffering at the same time. So that also means that the path is not about eliminating pain. Even the Buddha had challenges. He had back pain. He had people insulting him for the rest of his life, even after he was enlightened. He wasn't universally loved, but he didn't suffer for it. So the path is about eliminating suffering, eliminating the sense of lack or the sense of offness. It's the only option, actually, since pain is inherent to the human condition once we have a body. So the Buddha assigns a task to each of the noble truths, and dukkha itself, the first noble truth, is to be understood. The second noble truth, the origin of dukkha, is to be abandoned. The third, which is the cessation of dukkha, is to be realized. And the fourth, which is the path leading to the cessation of dukkha, is to be developed or cultivated. So I'm mostly going to focus on the first, but that actually doesn't mean that they go sequentially, like you have to completely understand dukkha before you can go on to the next one. Actually, it's nothing is really that linear in the Buddha's teaching. So all four truths are kind of understood in a progressively deeper way as you walk along the path. So why are we supposed to understand dukkha? Actually, the Buddha was brilliant. It turns out that the process of understanding suffering and really going into that contains the path itself. So the practices that you need to do in order to understand suffering are also the practices that are inherent to the fourth truth that develop the path. It's actually a property of the mind that when it sees deeply how suffering is occurring, it lets go. This is good news. This is just how the mind works. It's actually built to free itself. And the main problem is that we get in our own way. So there's actually a classic story that I just love about a butterfly that's coming out of the chrysalis. It's just starting to emerge. And it can be a real temptation because they really struggle at it. I don't know if you've ever watched this, but they kind of break out and then, you know, there's like, not the opening isn't big enough, and it seems like they can't get out. And it's real tempting to just go over there and, you know, sort of open it and help it get out. But it turns out that nature has created it this way, that the biological process of struggling out of the chrysalis pumps fluid through the wings of the butterfly that have been newly formed. And if it doesn't do that struggle, then the wings don't get filled with fluid and they'll never work. It can't fly. So our engagement with dukkha, this is an analogy, that our engagement with dukkha is not always easy, but the very challenge is what prepares the mind to transform. So actually, in the words of Andrea, who speaks a lot about dukkha, turning towards suffering makes us more ethical, more reliable, more stable, and more noble. So that's why this is a noble truth, that it ennobles us as we work with it. So understanding suffering means looking at it, turning toward it. Our usual response to suffering is to push it away, cover it up, deny it, get lost in it, grasp for something pleasant, anything but just standing there and looking at it. Maybe you've seen some of these patterns in your own mind. So the Buddha says, stop all that and just look. Accept that what is happening is dukkha, and right there you've created some space. You've allowed your mind to look at suffering and not be caught in its orbit and sucked into it. And you actually end up just learning something about it at an intuitive level. It may not seem like you're doing anything. You know, you're sitting there saying, okay, I've watched this knee pain for a long time now. But there's a process going on in the background where you are understanding it. There's a very nice quote in a book by Analayo that says, developing an understanding of the first noble truth involves not so much the revelation that dukkha exists as the realization of what dukkha is. So as we look more and more at dukkha, you know, it's like, okay, the first noble truth says there is suffering. You can think that you're done with it right away. Okay, I got it. I know there's suffering. But as you look more and more, you start seeing, oh, actually there's suffering there also. I didn't quite see that this other way that I am in the world also contains suffering. And so we see more and more the more subtle ways that there is suffering in the experiences that we have in life, which allows us to let go at a deeper and deeper level. In all cases, the dukkha is our mind's reaction. That's a really crucial point. It's not the objects that are causing the suffering, but the mind's response to them. The craving, the clinging, avoiding, rejecting, and selfing or identification that goes on in our minds when we encounter certain objects. So that's actually the second noble truth that arises from the first noble truth. It's the mind that's the key to suffering and its end. So this is another radical shift in our life when we gain the ability to start observing suffering with mindfulness. Don't underestimate the radicalness of this act, by the way. If you can do it in any way, shape, or form, you are doing something amazing that not very many humans do. So it may feel like the efforts aren't so great, but any moment of mindfulness is really profound. So I want to focus a lot on how to understand dukkha. And there are many, many practices to do this. This is what the Buddha taught, how to really engage and understand this quality of unsatisfactoriness. So in this talk, I'm going to give three specific approaches that are very practical. And then because those three stand for so many, I want to actually back away from those afterwards and talk about the two general principles that I think are going on in the process of understanding suffering. So here are the specific ones. The first one is to ground yourself in the body. So many types of suffering bring with them some kind of a physical component, usually a physical discomfort, like some kind of tension that you can feel, especially emotions. It's very easy to be caught in the emotion that we're having, the anger or the sadness or the depression, and it can be so helpful to bring the attention back towards the body and feel, oh, you know, this is causing a tension through my shoulder, or I feel something in the pit of my stomach when I have that emotion. And this is important because the body stays in the present moment, and so it's much easier if you're focused on the bodily experience not to wander off into the thoughts, the stories, the reactions that go with whatever emotion is happening. And it also quells the mind's tendency to fix and adjust and react if you just stay with the bodily experience. And there are many, many examples in the suttas of analogies that the Buddha gives for mind states that are physical. Like, for example, he says that anger is like swallowing a red-hot iron ball. And this is more than just a colorful metaphor. This is something that you can experience for yourself. Is that when you're angry, most people feel something, feel heat of some kind, and often centered in the belly area. So see if you can experience that for yourself and discover. It's fascinating then to go and read the suttas after you've had, you know, practiced meditation in this way and really see, oh, 2,600 years ago they were saying the same thing. Their minds weren't that different. Their minds and bodies are the same. It actually provides some confidence in the teachings, you know, that were, because it's easy to think these were written down so long ago in a completely different culture. But when you read anger is a red-hot iron ball and you know that's true for yourself, then it provides some understanding that these teachings are quite deep. The second specific way to approach dukkha is to begin to relate it to our experience of time and to understand that dukkha occurs only in the present moment. So even if we're experiencing a memory of something that was uncomfortable or we're anxious about something that might happen in the future, those feelings are occurring in the present. Memories of the past occur in the present. Projections onto the future occur in the present. Pain in our body occurs in the present. And in fact, we begin to see that right now, things are probably okay. If you're sitting on your cushion in a safe room, it's probably okay at this exact moment. So whatever you're feeling is something that's going on in the mind. And then you get a chance to really examine that from a position of safety. And just having that background understanding that right now it's okay actually deepens your ability to see what's happening in that moment at the mind. The other thing that it does is it starts to show how unsatisfactoriness is conditioned. So you can be sitting there just fine in your meditation and actually maybe you're not having any suffering. You know, by the way, you don't suffer every single moment. You might be sitting there, it's calm, it's peaceful, and then you have a thought that says, oh, I have to do that presentation tomorrow. And instantly you feel a shot through your body, you know, that feeling of shock, like, oh, you know, and it runs through your body and you can see, oh, it was conditioned. That thought happened and then there was that feeling in my body. And if you hang on, you say, oh my gosh, that's right, there's that presentation, I really have to think about that. You'll notice that that feeling continues, that physical feeling continues in your body. And so you're starting to understand at an intuitive level, oh, it's that thought that causes this feeling. I don't have this feeling in my stomach all the time. It's coming about because of something that happened beforehand. So that's really important. Dukkha does not arise from a vacuum. It doesn't arise for no reason. It arises from a matrix of conditions that can be discerned and let go of. The third specific approach to understanding dukkha is to begin to see experience in terms of what's called the five aggregates, and specifically in the way those aggregates arise and pass. So what's that about? So the Buddha actually provides some further help on what dukkha is. You remember I read that thing at the beginning that says birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, these are all dukkha. After he says that long paragraph, there's one more sentence, and it's a summary. It says, in short, the five aggregates subject to clinging are dukkha, or the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. So what does that mean? The five aggregates actually refer to the components of our experience. It's just you take all of your experience, everything that can happen in terms of sights, sounds, smells, thoughts, and you can divide it up into five categories. And the Buddha says very clearly that the clinging to these five aggregates is what causes suffering. So let me just say what these five categories of experience are. The first is usually called form, but it really just means the physicality of existence, our bodies and the objects outside that we experience. The second is feeling, which is not necessarily emotions, but it's the feeling tone of experience. Is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neither unpleasant nor pleasant? It's just sort of how does this experience feel to me? The third is perception, which is basically the labeling of experience, the discerning and labeling of what something is. I would call this, you know, a bell. Of course, it could also be a bowl or a hat or something like that. But, you know, the perception is what we decide to call it. And then the fourth is sometimes called volitional formations or mental formations, which is kind of the stories, the narratives, the habits of our mind, the other things that are going on volitionally in our mental experience. The understanding, for example, that when I see someone, I see them as a person, and then what comes with it is, oh yes, that's my neighbor who's lived in that house for 5 years, and last week we had that strange conversation. You know, that all comes in when I have the experience of seeing that person. All of those are the mental formations that come along with it. And then the fifth aggregate is very simple. It's consciousness, which is just the knowing of experience. And this is actually it. I mean, this covers the totality of experience. There's the physical part, which is all in the form, the rupa, and then the mental part is divided into four pieces: feeling, perception, mental formations, and the knowing of them, the consciousness. Basically, rearranging, holding on to, trying to control these five aspects of experience is the life strategy that we adopt habitually: seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. It will never work. It basically amounts to rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. Why? Because all experience, all of these five aggregates have three characteristics that go with them. And I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not saying these as things that you should know or that you need to memorize or that you need to believe. I'm just telling you what the teachings say, and I think that as you do the practice, they will emerge. So don't worry too much about them if you're not familiar with them. The first is that experience is impermanent. It always changes. It will never stay the same forever. The second is that it is not a true source of happiness. It's unsatisfactory. That's dukkha, actually, is one of the three characteristics of existence. And then the third is that it is not a self. It's not a reliable, essential, substantial self, not your body, not your thoughts, not your emotions. How could they? They change all the time. And you're not at all the same person you were a year ago, much less 40 years ago. So these things are all not part of ourself. So the more we look, the more we understand that the problem in trying to rearrange and control and run around with all these five aggregates is that we're trusting them beyond what they can provide. It's an essential quality that they change and that they're not reliable and that they're unsatisfactory. So we can't ever rearrange them into something that is reliable, happy, satisfactory, and worthy of being ourself. It's just not possible. They're not a suitable refuge. And of course, understanding this intellectually, like now when I'm telling it to you, isn't necessarily going to solve the problem, but it can at least provide a foundation for understanding, oh, okay, this problem really is serious, this existential offness that we feel, that our axle is not quite aligned as we move through life. So there comes a point on the path. So basically, just keep exploring this. And there comes a point on the path where we directly experience some of these three characteristics. For example, the fundamental impermanence. We really experience that everything that's arising is passing away just as quickly. And we may agree with this at a top level, but directly experiencing that in meditation irreversibly changes our understanding of experience so that we don't really believe in the substantiality of these objects anymore. We become disenchanted with what they can provide us. So then we're ready to seek something more reliable. And all of us have seen this at some level. That's actually why you're in this room, probably, in some way. So this can start to sound complex. You know, here I'm telling you about five aggregates and which aggregate am I experiencing, and I'm supposed to watch it rising and then passing away, and I'm supposed to look for these three characteristics. Don't worry about all that. These are practices that kind of develop over time, and I don't want to give the impression that understanding dukkha is a huge project that has to have all these different components, and then I have to think about, you know, this and that. Don't worry about that. There's actually two general phenomena that have to go on in studying dukkha. And they sound contradictory, which is the great thing. I love these teachings that, you know, they always sound contradictory, but they're not contradictory. They actually happen at the same time, and they happen together, and they provide the path, and they're very simple. So the first is, the first approach is, in a certain sense, we need to accept dukkha. And what that means is that's the turning towards it that we talked about earlier. It's taking in the first noble truth rather than avoiding, denying, rejecting, hiding from the truth of suffering. There is suffering, and we decide that we're going to turn towards it and we're going to get close to it and we're going to start really looking at it and seeing how it's a part of everything, how the relentless change of experience renders everything unsuitable as a lasting form of happiness. So the first approach is basically accepting dukkha. The second approach is not accepting dukkha. That's all there is, right? So because what we discover when we investigate dukkha is we discover our own contribution to it. And you know, you may not want to hear this right away, but basically, it's wanting things to be other than they are. So we discover that we're causing the suffering by not accepting the way things are, in some sense. And that doesn't mean you don't do social action, and we can talk about that, but I'm talking now at a very basic level. So we start beginning to wonder, how long am I going to keep doing this? How much longer am I going to tolerate my mind creating this? At some point, it's enough. Enough suffering. There must be a way out. So, you know, we accept suffering to the point where we can't accept it anymore. And then the mind's ready to let go. We let go in myriad ways all along the path. You know, I'm not talking about some huge thing. You might notice a moment of impatience while you're waiting in line in the grocery store, and then you let go, and you say, oh, I'm just waiting in this line. That's all that's happening. I don't need to make a problem out of it. And you let go, and then there's ease. Oh, I can just follow my breath for 5 minutes while I'm waiting in line. And there's the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. You were impatient, you saw it, you let go, you were happier. That's what this is about. And then as it goes along, you know, then we let go of our traffic frustration, or you know, we may at some point be able to let go of bigger sufferings in our life, like the anger we've been carrying at our parents for 40 years. At some point we say, gosh, I'm the one carrying this. If I didn't have it, it would be better for me. Or maybe our ex-spouse, maybe that one's a little closer, but you know, at some point, okay, how much longer am I going to keep doing this? Each of these brings peace and happiness in proportion to what we let go of. Thich Nhat Hanh says, if you let go a little, you'll gain a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll gain a lot of peace. And if you let go completely, you'll gain complete peace. So at some point, we're ready for the big kahuna, and we're ready to let go of everything and look for the deathless. So I'd be remiss not to go all the way at this point and describe just how far the understanding of dukkha can take us. And I'll do it as well as I can. Some of it is not part of my experience. So it's said that there are actually three gates to liberation: anicca, dukkha, and anatta, the three characteristics. As the mind moves toward liberation, one of these characteristics will become prominent in our experience. And you don't have to worry about looking for it or whatever, because you don't actually get a choice about your gateway. It's said that every mind goes through one of these three gates, and it's determined by various things that aren't under your control. So you'll get one of them. So let's look at dukkha in particular, since that's the subject. How is dukkha a gateway to liberation? It is said that people who practice concentration and are good at tranquility, especially, will go through the gate of dukkha. But since you don't get a choice, don't worry about it. There are a few routes that the mind can take, as I understand it, to go through this gate. I'm just going to give two of them. The most commonly described way is that to realize the cessation of dukkha is actually through the study of anicca, through a permanent impermanence. So I talked about paying attention to the rise and fall of the aggregates. And if we continually observe that in the present moment with sustained mindfulness that is continuous for a long time, the mind eventually gets it. Everything is changing, and therefore nothing is satisfactory. I mean, it really gets this at a deep level. And basically, all experience takes on the characteristic of unbearability. Nothing is bearable because the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness, is seen immediately. As soon as an experience is had, unbearable, unbearable. I don't want that, don't want that. And the mind drops everything and can turn to the deathless. It goes through the gate of dukkha. So the image for this type of liberation is a lotus leaf that rejects all the water that comes onto it. It just immediately flows off. There's nothing whatsoever worth clinging to. You may have heard that as a summary of the teachings. Gill says that a lot. And the mind that really does that, that really actualizes that, is free. So an alternative route for the gate of dukkha is one that I heard described by John Peacock, actually, when he was here teaching about a month ago. And he said, it is because we don't perceive things as impermanent and not self that we perceive them as dukkha. I thought this was very interesting. So this is basically says that the mind can at some point realize that dukkha is basically a misperception. We didn't realize that something was impermanent and not self, and therefore we were clinging to it and expecting it to be permanent and self, and so we suffered. And so actually, when you see the three characteristics, I mean, the three characteristics can sound depressing. It's like every element of experience is suffering, well, you know, here I am, I'm a human, I'm going to have this for the rest of my life at least. Does that mean I suffer every moment? As I become more and more sensitive to suffering, I see that I suffer every moment. And this quote from John Peacock reminds us, well, no, actually, suffering is a misperception, so it's possible to stop perceiving that quality of existence as suffering. I think this is a fascinating way, and the mind that can continually not be fooled by anicca and anatta, cannot continually not be fooled and understand that everything is impermanent and not self, will not suffer. It will not experience dukkha. So more and more, the path of practice becomes an act of letting go of clinging in the moment. Whatever clinging is happening in this moment, you let it go. That's the path. And that's something that you can do each moment and can do every moment for the rest of your life, again and again. And we get better and better at letting go, so there's more and more moments where we can be free. That's how it works. So then dukkha is basically our constant companion. We look for the suffering, we let it go. Where's the suffering? Let it go. And it can be our constant friend on the journey that we're taking, the journey of our five aggregates through life. So basically, in that way, dukkha becomes a continual gateway. We don't have to think of this, you know, the giant gateway that I'm sure we imagine, like the gateway to heaven or something. It's like, I'm going to go through that and be in Nibbana. But it's actually just a continual gateway every moment. Let go of the suffering that's happening right now. This is the promise of investigating dukkha, far from something depressing. So we may begin with the personal suffering that's going on in our lives, but ultimately the process of release from suffering is not something personal. Basically, like I said before, when the mind sees the disadvantage of something with clarity and insight, it lets go. That's what it does. So we create the conditions for this natural process by purifying our actions, by stilling the mind, and by observing carefully. That's the part that we can contribute. We're all standing at the gate. Does anyone here not perceive unsatisfactoriness in their life? So that's right there is a gate. So we can awaken each moment that we touch this very human suffering we have with our heart that is open, compassionate, and curious. Freedom happens each moment. Let's just sit together for a few minutes. We have time for maybe one question or comment, if anybody has anything. Yeah. Oh, would you, could we get you to use a microphone? Down underneath there are hand mics. Yeah. Press the button so that it turns green. Thank you. This is for the benefit of the recording.
You said the three things, dukkha was the middle one. And the other two were words that I don't know. Can you make them English?
Yes. I'm sorry that I didn't adequately explain which was English and which was Pali. So the first word was anicca, which means impermanence. And then there's dukkha. And then the third word is anatta, which means not self. Not self. Yeah.